Every now and then, I surprise myself by my choice of guests on the show, and today's one of those days. When I received his newest book in the mail, I noted Rick Steves' name and figured I knew who he was, a genial, low-key host of travel shows on PBS and public radio. Why would they think I'd want to interview him? Then I noticed the title, Travel as a Political Act, and the publisher, Nation Books, and I gave it a second thought. I like it when someone does something better than they have to, or take stands or risks they don't have to take. Rick Steves has a comfortable business and a comfortable place in our culture and media. He helps people learn how to make travel less stressful and more enjoyable. But in this book, he sticks his neck out. He's traveled to and written about Iran, El Salvador, Turkey, for instance, in ways that challenge what passes for conventional wisdom. Of course, conventional wisdom is often a contradiction in terms. Conventional meaning parochial, provincial, small-minded, with little possibility of wisdom. Not only that, Steve serves on the board of Normal and has given keynote speeches calling for legalization of marijuana. So, he's my guest. Though he received degrees at the University of Washington, he says his real education came in Europe. Since 1973, he spent 4 months a year in Europe, spending one-third of his adult life living out of a suitcase has shaped his thinking. Today, he produces Europe Through the Back Door guidebooks, a travel series in America on public television, a weekly hour-long national public radio show, and a syndicated weekly column. Welcome, Rick Steves.
Thanks, Terry. I'm glad you have a travel writer on your show.
Yes. And thank you for your help during our recent fund drive. We really appreciate it.
Well, I just think it's good citizenship to recognize the value of public broadcasting, radio or TV.
Exactly. I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we deal with. So how did travel become your work as well as your play?
Well, I've only had two jobs in my life. I was a piano teacher and now a travel teacher. And I never wanted to go to Europe. My dad used to import pianos from Germany. I live up in Seattle. And he dragged me to Europe as a 14-year-old. I remember distinctly not wanting to go. I thought it was a stupid idea. But I got over there, and it was a wonderland. And I traveled with my parents a couple times. Then I remember I was in the Copenhagen train station with my mom and dad, and there was these kids a couple years older than me with rucksacks and rail passes, no parents in sight, exciting destinations clicking up in that reader board, Berlin, Amsterdam, Helsinki. I remember looking at those kids and then looking at my parents thinking, I don't need you guys for this, you know. And I vowed to go back to Europe every year since. And that was when I was 17 years old, and I have. At first, I did it as a piano teacher who realized kids won't practice in the summer. So let's just take a break. I'll see you in September.
Earn as much as you can during the year.
And then play in the summer. Like, that's made good balance to me. And then I had a piano studio with a recital hall, and I found myself teaching travel classes in my recital hall. And all the parents were coming to the recitals of the kids, sitting on boxes of my first book, Europe Through the Back Door. And I had to make up my mind, am I going to teach travel or am I going to teach piano? Could do one or the other, and I really love teaching travel. So for the last 30 years, I've been teaching travel. It's interesting when I look back on that, because now I've got a $40 million business with 70 employees, and I got all this wonderful technology where I can produce a radio show in my own office up in Seattle and have a TV show and all that. It's very grassroots, very guerrilla kind of entrepreneurial. But my teaching has evolved over 30 years. For the first decade, it was cheap tricks, budget travel, Europe Through the Back Door. That was the 80s. In the 90s, I found myself, I get to teach whatever I want to teach. You know, somebody says, give a talk, I can talk about whatever I want. So I stopped talking about cheap tricks, and I started talking about art and history and cuisine and culture appreciation. That was the 1990s for me, a higher sort of thinking travel instead of just stowing away in the boat or getting a picnic lunch. And my book was Europe 101, History and Art for Travelers. Now, in this decade, since 9/11, I find myself, when somebody hires me to go across the country and give a talk, I don't talk about cheap tricks, I don't talk about art. I talk about how travel can broaden your perspective and make you a more thankful American, as well as a better citizen of the planet, a more comfortable citizen of the planet. And this has sort of evolved, and that's what this new book is, Travel as a Political Act. But when I think about it, it's like a Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Remember that one?
Oh, yeah.
I think people know that. And in the bottom rungs, you're just worrying about your clothes and your food and your house. Then you get creative. And then I think higher up on that triangle, you get into altruism or something like that, maybe. And I see a similar hierarchy of travel objects. First, you want to just survive and eat and sleep. Then you want to enjoy the food and the history and the art. And then you want to broaden your perspective. And that's subversive in our industry.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I think tourism is arguably the biggest. It's either tourism or weaponry that's the biggest industry on the planet. And certainly tourism is massive, and it employs lots of people. And the promotion, all the money that shapes all the information that shapes our travel dreams is trying to dumb you down and get you just fun in the sun on the beach, frequent flyer miles, duty-free shopping. What's the power of my sunscreen? Now, my job is to smart up travel. This is subversive because nobody makes money off of you if you take a left turn and go to Bosnia instead of a right turn and go to the cruise port.
In other words, you're going upstream against the business you're part of.
Yeah. I mean, they want you to be dumbed down and shop. And I got no problem with hedonism and fun in the sun, but I just think people also can do more than that in their travels, and they don't have to, but the industry will not tell them they have that option. Me, as a travel teacher, for 25 years, I led groups around on tour buses, and it's always been my passion is to challenge self-assured, ethnocentric Americans. I think we Americans find more truths to be self-evident and God-given than anybody else on the planet. And, you know.
Many more than the three Jefferson noted.
I think so. And, you know, what's really fun for me is to know that other people find different truths to be self-evident and God-given. And we're not going to change them. Half my life, well into my adult life, I believed the world is a pyramid with us on top and everybody else trying to figure it out. And it's late. I remember I wanted Alexander Haig to be president because we knew the truth and we could elect a government for them that got it. Well, then I spent a little time overseas talking to smart people, well-educated people that had nowhere near the freedom or affluence or opportunity that I had, and they wouldn't trade passports. They liked being who they were. That just blew me away.
And so it was travel that changed you politically.
Oh, yeah. If I had stayed home, I'd still be, you know, peace through strength, our way or the highway.
And teaching piano.
And teaching piano, yeah. So I'm just very thankful for the travel. And you know what I see, Terry, is a lot of good, smart Americans go over there, and they've got to take the initiative to have travel impact their lives, and the industry is not going to give it to them. Time and time again, I see this. It's just they travel all around the world and they come home more ethnocentric than ever before, more frightened than ever before. There's a lot of fear in our society. There's been a huge amount of fear in the last decade, and it's used against us. It's evil. And I think the flip side of fear is understanding. And when I'm afraid of a place, I go there and I realize, you know, there's nothing to be afraid of in this place. A year ago, we went to Iran with my public television film crew. I was scared.
Were you really?
Yeah, I was honestly scared. I came very close to leaving our big expensive TV camera in Athens and going in with our little sneak camera, you know, because I just thought I don't want them when they realize we're Americans, you know, they're good people, but they've got misunderstandings about us and they'd throw stuff at us, you know. I got to the streets of Tehran a year ago this month, and I've never received such a warm welcome by people in the streets when they realized I was an American as when I was in Tehran. It was incredible.
I've looked at the video and you have exactly that where you say who you are and one after another. Now, of course, you can edit. But,
you know, they don't like our president any more than we like their president.
Well, that was true when you were there. It may be
changing.
That's
different now. Oh, yeah. No, it is. Well, it's different now. But they're still threatened by us. And we're still, you know, we've got a new president, but we're still outvoted in the United Nations 140-4 on a lot of things that matter to the desperately poor half of humanity. So we have a little work to do.
Oh, absolutely.
And that's just what my Travel as a Political Act book is all about. It's inspiring Americans who have the opportunity to travel to get something valuable out of it. I think the most important souvenir that I bring home is a broader understanding and an empathy for people and just a delight in the diversity of this planet.
I would imagine that in some sense, the scale of your mission has changed. In other words, as you move up that hierarchy.
Well, it is interesting because I probably wouldn't be talking to you if all I was doing is getting cute little cafes in Madrid, you know?
That's right.
And I really like this. And I get to be the medieval jester, you know, and it's so clear to me. You know, in the Middle Ages, the jester was employed by the king. You know, he got fed and clothed and housed in the court. But the jester could go out there and goof around with the people in the gutters, in the barrios. And he was welcome to come back into the court and tell the king the truth. And the king needed to know that. Now, today we don't have jesters, but we have travelers. Travel writers can be the cheerleaders and the tour guides and so on. But all of us are travelers, and we can go over there and we do two things. We break down misunderstandings that media and propaganda make about us to them, and vice versa. We realize how powerful media and propaganda is here in our society that wants us to be afraid of the rest of the world so we can continue spending as 4% of this planet more than everybody else put together on our military. That's a tough sell when you have a smart electric like we have and you're trying to convince us that we need to spend as much money as we do on our military. Again, we're 4% of the planet. We spend more than everybody else put together. And even today, in this relatively enlightened time, you can't get elected without promising more for military. Well, that's involves a lot of fear and a lot of salesmanship.
And a lot of ignorance.
And a lot of people who are more afraid of the world than they need to be.
Let's talk about Iran. What's from having immersed yourself in Iran and put a lot of effort into that documentary, what's your sense of what's happening? What's your feeling? Speak about Iran at this moment.
Right. Well, when I went to Iran, Terry, it occurred to me, I wanted to understand what made these people vote for a guy like Ahmadinejad. Why would he do that? And he says stuff that's wacky. The Holocaust doesn't happen. Kill gays, kill Baha'is. Israel needs to be wiped out. What's going on? And then I learned he is talking to his political base. We would call it shoring up your political base. If John McCain or Hillary says we will obliterate them or bum, 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 Iran, they're not talking to Iran. They're talking to their political base. Ahmadinejad's in power with about the same margin as President Bush. And he's in power because his base is the less educated, small town, fearful, fundamentalist Iranian parent. They're motivated by the same thing, I would say, the less educated, small town, fearful, fundamentalist American is motivated by. Fear and love. Good people, afraid of the world, mm-hmm. loving their kids, mm-hmm. not wanting somebody else's values to corrupt their children. I had women in Iran come across the street to me when they saw me and knew when I was an American. They said, "We just don't want our children to be raised like Britney Spears." And I said, well, I thought, neither do we. You know?
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, I've got kids.
But they think that we all want our kids to be boy toys, drug addicts, and crass materialists. And she was scared to death. Now, why is that? Well, because in 1953, they had a prime minister that took over their country so they could nationalize their oil. We couldn't allow that, so we had to throw him out and put in the Shah of Iran because he would let our companies have their way with Iranian oil. That sounds like a liberal thing, but that's pretty much an accepted fact. There's no spin there. That's just the history of it.
That's right.
And for a generation, they had the Shah of Iran running their country, and they bragged that the miniskirts are shorter in Paris, they're shorter in Tehran than they are in Paris. Now, that may be fun for you and me, but if you're that small town, frightened, loving parent, you're scared to death, and you have an alternative, which is a theocracy. They traded their democracy for a theocracy because they're so afraid. If Ahmadinejad loses this election, it's because we're more difficult to demonize. If Bush was in power in the United States today, there'd be no riots in Iran right now because Ahmadinejad would be in slam dunk.
That's right.
I firmly believe that.
Yeah.
Those people want freedom, but something they want more than freedom is a society where they can raise their kids without Western corrupting influence. We have a lot of people in America that care about women's rights, and they're disgusted at the way Iranians treat their women. I would hazard to say that those people who are so disgusted don't know really the big picture. When an Iranian looks at our country and they think of women rights, they think of some babe in a tight skirt standing on a revolving table in a car show selling hot rods. Do you know that image?
Oh, yeah.
Now, what's that? For us, that's good marketing. For them, that's insulting to that woman, and they're not going to let it happen. Now, they would judge us, and we would take it in stride, just like we would judge them in certain things that we don't understand. Why do women worship separately in a mosque? A lot of people think it's putting down women. No, by the nature of praying in Islam, you bend down a lot. Your butt is high in the air. I liken that to me in the back row of a jazzercise class on Saturday morning, trying to think about God with all sorts of women bending down in front of me. It's tough. Separate the men and the women and focus on God. And it's a male-dominated society, so the men get the front row.
Right.
You know, but that's just – it's more complicated. Terry, I was in Tehran is an exciting city, 10 million people, full of traffic jams. I was stuck in a traffic jam many times. One time our driver just out of the blue blurted out, "Death to traffic." And I almost had whiplash. I go, "What? I thought it was death to America." He said, "No, in Iran, whenever we're frustrated by something and it's out of our control, we say death to that." And I thought, well, that doesn't excuse them by saying a death to America, but it does give it a little more complexity than what the average American bumper sticker political knee-jerk reaction might be. I've noticed in the riots just recently or the demonstrations, they're saying death to Ahmadinejad or death to all sorts of things.
Yeah,
yeah, that's what when you translate it, I believe it's damn. You know, damn. When you say damn those teenagers, you're not saying you want them to die and burn in hell for eternity. You're just saying it's after midnight. Turn the music down. Damn those teenagers.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of things that frustrate them. There's a lot of things that's out of control, and they say, damn those people. So I'm just saying when you travel, you're less liable to let people with an agenda here make a fool out of you.
Mm-hmm.
And
that
in itself is worth any American who's going to be traveling to consider traveling as a political act.
Having said what you just said, let me go to what was going to be my last question, which was, what advice would you give listeners if they were thinking about traveling this summer, or they were thinking about traveling this year, and now they go, the economy's tough, the dollars, you know, I'm not going to do it.
Right.
What would you say?
Well, I mean, the economy's tough, and I've been doing this for 30 years, and the dollar's up, the dollar's down, there's a bombing, there's a terrorist act, the economy's bad, and more people travel or less people travel. You know, my own staff, I mean, we take 400 groups around Europe every year. It's a huge part of our business, and we're down about 25-30% this year. I don't get depressed about it because we shouldn't have been up as high as we were before, because that's the result of goosing our economy for a generation for political reasons. And if you goose something repeatedly, pretty soon it stops responding.
In other words, they were traveling on the bubble.
They were traveling on the bubble, yeah. So it's tough. And fewer people travel, but you can still, if you're reasonably employed and you arrange your priorities away, you don't need to be rich to travel. If you do travel, whether it's south of the border to Mexico or whether it's to the Caribbean or whether it's to the Mediterranean, you have the option to make a choice. That's what I love to inspire. I'm trying to inspire people to do in travel as a political act. I had a chance to go to Mazatlan a few years ago.
Uh-huh.
Lay on the beach. I was tired. My wife and daughter wanted to go to lay on the beach. I love Mazatlan. Senior frog, you know, free martinis, all that kind of stuff. The same week they were celebrating or remembering the 25th anniversary of the assassination of Archbishop Oscar Romero in San Salvador. I told my wife, Ann, I'm going to be miserable. No fun in the beach in Mazatlan. I've got to go to San Salvador. Perverse sort of tourism on my part, but that's just me. I'm curious about the world, and I want to know what it's like to be on the receiving end of globalization. I want to march with people who lost their civil war against the United States, you see. And I was with priests and nuns who were excommunicated but continued to be doing their work because they said part of their vow of obedience to the church is disobedience to the church with a capital C. That's so inspiring to me. I love it, the power of these poor people. I was in a country that was dollarized now. I mean, in the little ashtray in the taxi, it was nickels and dimes and quarters instead of their money. They're part of our system. It's a new affluence. There's a Wendy's and a Dunkin' Donuts on every corner in El Salvador.
Really?
Yeah. I was in a country that's leadership was in power because the left-wingers almost won, and then Jeb Bush thought, we thought we better send Jeb Bush down to remind the people in a TV ad that if they vote for the leftist, the United States will stop remittances coming down from our country. A quarter of El Salvador's income comes from their sons working in America, sending checks back by Western Union or whatever.
And a quarter.
And Jeb Bush said in a beautiful ad, there's a sad old woman who was relying on the income sent down from the United States to her humble little barrio existence. Mom, if you elect the leftist, this will be my last check to support you. And what's this? This lady's not very politically astute. And she says, I better vote for the right winger or I'm on the streets. You see, that's democracy. When I talk to Father John Sobrino, who survived, he's one of the Jesuit intellectuals that didn't get killed down there at the University of Central America. He said, these days when I hear the word democracy, my bowels move.
Mm.
And that's a sad state for democracy south of our border. I went to a Vietnam memorial in San Salvador that is a perfect knockoff of our beautiful black granite Vietnam memorial in Washington, D.C. Tens of thousands of names chiseled onto that stone memorial, and each one of those people died fighting my country. Maybe they were evil communists. Maybe we had to kill them. Doesn't matter. They have loved ones. They have people that still finger those names and think about my lost husband or father or uncle. That's powerful stuff. That was cheap. That was easy. That was no risk. I had to eat rice and beans one day and beans and rice the next day instead of senior frogs. But that, for me, was a rich travel experience, and it was simply a choice, Mazatlan or San Salvador. Now, last week I was in Dubrovnik. It was a human traffic jam of people coming off the cruise ship. I couldn't walk down the street. All these people are just so excited they could eat five meals a day and still snorkel when they get in the port.
Right, right.
And I enjoyed Dubrovnik, and it was a lot of fun. But then I complemented that touristic experience by going 2 hours inland to Mostar in Bosnia. And I learned about how a country is mending after ripping itself to shreds literally 15 years ago when they had their terrible war there. This is the cultural fault line where East meets West, where Islam meets Christendom, where the Ottoman Empire met the Habsburg Empire, where World War I started and where this war happened. I mean, there's a lot of rubbing.
Yeah, yeah.
And if we Americans want to understand why the turmoil, we need to go there.
Yeah.
And it is exciting to go there. And I got to have dinner on the Boulevard, which used to be the front line in that city. It was a divided city. And the Boulevard, just 2 months ago, had its first restaurant opened up in the aftermath of the war. You're surrounded by bullet-pocked buildings. And,
sure.
And you've got the call to prayer wafting through the air, and then you've got a church spire across the Boulevard, which is shaped like a minaret and twice as tall as all the other minarets. So you still have that tension. But you have kids who are partying together. and you have parents that have learned that we shouldn't be sniping each other. You got city parks that were city parks in 1992, and today they're filled with tombstones, all with the same year, 1993. It's very poignant. It's not happy, happy. Thomas Jefferson said, travel makes a person wiser if less happy. I have an appetite to understand what's going on in the world. And from a citizenship point of view, and what's a good American point of view, we owe it to, if we have the wherewithal to travel anywhere where we can come home and help our country fit better and smarter into this ever smaller planet. We just can't go it alone. We're 4% of this planet.
Sure, exactly. You know?
And,
exactly.
We've got to get smart.
You also have taken courageous stands, I say, only because they are so seldom taken by people that don't have sort of a dog in the fight about the war on drugs. The statistics you said about the, you know, our percentage of the population of the world population and our percentage of defense, well, our percentage of the world population and our percentage of people in prison is unrivaled as well. What's your you got a minute. What's your take on the war on drugs?
Well, all I know is I've spent third of my adult life in Europe, where people are dealing with the same struggle. And they are doing much better on their war against drug abuse and drug problems than we are, because they're measuring the effectiveness of their drug policies, not by how many people do you lock up, but by a concept called harm reduction. They know from a pragmatic point of view, if you can take the crime out of the drugs and treat it as a health problem, you're going to reduce harm in your society. The result is fewer people use drugs, fewer people die from drugs, fewer people are in prison in Europe, and they don't lock people up for that. We have 80,000 people in jail today for smoking marijuana. We arrested more people last year than ever before, over 800,000 people for simple possession of pot. In Europe, a joint is about as exciting as a can of beer. I mean, and it's a fascinating experience, and nobody can talk about this, Terry. That's why I talk about it. It's just
exactly. That's what I applaud you for.
And I've been talking about it for 5 years. I'm a board member of Normal. I get to give the keynote talk, 4:20, if you know what time that is, at Hempfest in Seattle. And I'm proud of it because it's a citizenship thing. It's a civil liberties thing. It's an honesty thing. And I can bring a European perspective to this. And the interesting from a business point of view and a political point of view, it's been a boon to me. It's expensive from an underwriting point of view because corporations are scared to death about this. But if we're a free society, I'm not saying smoke pot. I'm saying stop making it a crime and treat it as a health problem, and you will reduce harm to your society. I'm against drug abuse. I'm certainly against kids getting involved in that. I'm for dealing with this problem in a way that solves it. In Europe, I'd love to talk about that, and it's a whole chapter in my book, Travel as a Political Act, talking about how the Swiss deal with their needle addiction problems and how the Dutch have their coffee shops and so on. And they're doing great things, and there's exciting stuff going on now. I guess I would just like to cross-promote that if people just want to go to ricksteves.com or Google Rick Steves and marijuana, they can learn a lot about what I'm talking about in drug policy change.
Very good. So again, Rick Steves' newest book is Travel as a Political Act. His website is ricksteves.com. You can listen to this week's conversation and many others at any time during the week by linking to our podcast. You can also sign up to have it delivered to you weekly. And for podcasts, articles, transcripts, and to get on a list where I send out a weekly announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and some background, email me at T.E. McNally. That's one word, T.E.M.C.N.A.L.L.Y. T.E. McNally at Mac.com. T.E. McNally at Mac.com. Rick Steves, keep up the good work.
Thank you. Pleasure to be with you, Terry.